Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Trainer Talks and Tales. You are, of course, joined by myself, and I am here with Tess. Hey, Tess.
Hello, Daisy. How are you? How's life?
Good. I have had such a good week. I have been away down in Perisher in New South Wales doing a bit of skiing, which I love. I love skiing so much, and I feel like I fell in love with it even more this holiday. So we're already thinking about where we're going to go next year. I was hoping to see like a little bit more wildlife, but unfortunately we saw a lot of wombats, but all on the side of the road that weren't looking too well. So there's a lot of roadkill down in that area just because there is such a surplus of animals, which is a good thing. But also, yeah, it would have been nice to see some wombats thriving. But we did see heaps of kangaroos, and we actually saw some emus, which I didn't think we'd see down there, which was awesome. They were just like marching around in the fields with some deer, which was really cool. And then at the very top of the ski slopes, we saw some corellas, some crimson corellas, which was Rosellas, sorry, which was really cool. I love those birds. They're so beautiful and like so nice to see them against the snow. So yeah, that was a really good trip. Work-wise this week, we have been busy still with breeding season a little bit with the penguins. I have been teaching one of our seals Saturday a head shake no behavior, and it has been very long time since I started this behavior because it's been a little bit more challenging than I first imagined. So I reached out to the marine animal training group that I'm part of on Facebook that's worldwide, and it's so awesome how many people suddenly jump in and share their thoughts, their ideas, how they've kind of established that behavior, and I've been able to take away some really good pointers from that. So excited to get stuck into a bit more training with her and progress that behavior where I can. Because it has had elements of a little bit of frustration from me. But as we know, it's all things that I'm doing that I need to change. Sorry. To make sure that I'm communicating with her in the best way. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes with that.
I love that. I think that that's the great thing about our society, or basically this community now, that we can just jump online and say, hey, I'm struggling with this. Do you have any tips? Do you have any pointers? And there's a so many people that are willing to help. So that's a great thing about this community that we're noticing. And I hope people are encouraged to do more of that because we're all learning together, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to touch as well, speaking now that you mentioned that, about our amazing community, something very special happened today. And I was at work and I was given a letter. This absolutely lovely person, so her name is Miku, and she is from Japan, and she actually handwrote me a letter and delivered it to Sea Life, which was just one of the most thoughtful things anyone's ever done, and like so lovely that people are still writing letters in this day and age. Basically just touching a little bit on the experience that she has in Japan and working with penguins and seals and turtles, and just kind of sharing about how grateful she is for the podcast. And it was, yeah, such a beautiful letter, and I just wanted to give her shout out because that takes a lot to write that and to deliver it. And I've reached out to her and hopefully going to get her to come into your cram and hang out for a little bit, meet some seals. So yeah, I just feel like this community is so incredibly kind and so thoughtful, and I count my blessings every day that we get to be a part of it.
I love that. Actual fan mail. That's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. And she had a shout out to you as well, which was lovely as well. So I love that. So yeah, if you're listening, we love you. Thank you so much. But anyway, Tess, how has your week been?
Yeah, really good. Obviously, I went camping last weekend. I think I touched on that last podcast. So that was really fun. I've got more camping with you this weekend.
Yay!
So that'll be fun. And I've booked a few more trips towards the end of the year too. I've got one with Kayla coming up who we're going to have on next week. So lots of camping for this mama. And the only other exciting thing is I'm heading into Lone Pine tomorrow with you.
Yay.
So that'll be fun. And it'll be good to catch up with other keepers, see the birds, and just have a nice day out. So that's about it for me, but I am looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be nice to go because I've never been with you when you've not been working. So it'll be nice for us to just kind of like hang out with Indy and Deli, one of our friends is coming too. So it'll be nice.
True. True. A little bit less me running around like a headless chicken being like, I've got to go to the show, but I'll see you afterwards. So
yeah.
I can just take Lucy.
Yeah, absolutely.
But did you want to tell us a little bit more about the guests and who we're chatting to today?
Yes, absolutely. So we are joined by Lou. So Lou is the primate keeper down at Sydney Zoo. So we have touched a little bit on Sydney Zoo recently. We chatted with Dean, but he put me in touch with Lou. And this episode, I say it in the episode, but I reckon this conversation has got to be one of my top five that we've ever had, which is really funny because it's not a species that I am particularly interested in working with. You know, I love all animals, don't get me wrong, but primates has never been something that stood out. But it absolutely changed my whole mindset around these animals, how we care for them, their cognitive abilities. It was just fascinating. Not only does she touch on the work that she's been doing in zoos for an incredibly long time, the training that she does, she also does some amazing stuff with conservation, working with wild orangutans on their enrichment and welfare programs. So please recommend, if listening to this, even if you're not a primate person, it is such a good episode and we really hope that you enjoy it. Lou, welcome to Trainer Talks and Tales. Tess and I are so excited to have you on today and chat all things primates.
Oh, thank you for having me. I have to say I'm a little bit excited to talk to you both as well. So, yes, always willing to chat primates.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we start every single episode here at Trainer Talks and Tales with a fast five. So I'm just going to throw five random questions at you and then we'll get your quick answers. Does that sound good?
Nervous. I've never been so nervous. Yes, go for it.
Okay, question number one. Oranges or apples?
Oh, wow. Oh, oranges.
Favorite country?
Oh, my God, Indonesia.
What is your current TV show that you're binge watching?
I can't actually say that out loud. Look, I'm going to be honest. EastEnders is my favorite TV show. Always support it. Watch it. I'm going to own that.
I love EastEnders too, I get that. Your favourite bird species?
Oh, yeah. Interesting. I'm not really a bird person, which is a common conversational point, but if anything, probably budgie. Probably budgie.
Okay, and last one might be a tough one, but are we going to go with orangutans or chimpanzees?
Oh, you're never going to get a true answer in that space. I can't. On moral grounds, ladies, I'm never going to just...
I thought that might be a bit of a curveball for you.
No, it's because it's a very frequently asked question. Look, yeah, I don't know. Both are incredibly important to me, but, chimps, maybe. It's just about just a little...
Hey, we got an answer.
you got an answer, you caught me.
Well, Lou, we cannot wait to dive into such a huge variety of things that you've achieved so far because the list is pretty incredible. However, we thought maybe to start off the podcast today, we could hear about what your career has looked like within zoos and how that has kind of led you to what you're doing now.
Ah, okay. So it's often I have to pinch myself to realise that I've been in the industry for over 30 years and I started as a very young 21-year-old at Taronga Zoo. I just finished undertaking a teaching degree at university, but my passion was always animals. From a very young child, I was always connected to them. So much so that, you know, my parents would come home and somehow I had acquired an animal from either the pet shop or a neighbour. Not always with permission, of course. So it was just, I think, a natural transition to head into the zoo world. And I guess way back when I started at So I'm going to have to admit that it was in the early 90s, which seems such a long time ago. I think back then zoos were still very much evolving into what I think is today representative of a real true conservation, you know, organisation. So I started there as a very young, impressionable person, and I had an opportunity to work across Taronga in many different departments. Passion of mine was always the strong, large megafauna, so rhinos in particular, something I was drawn to. But it wasn't long, and I think I'd been at Taronga for about a year, where I landed an opportunity to work in the primate department, and I think from that moment on, something flipped. Chimps just, I was just completely drawn to their social structure, you know, their social complexity, their behaviours, just everything about chimp was really interesting, and from there I sort of fell in love with primates. I stayed at Taronga for I think 23 years in total, and during that time I had the opportunity to do some incredible things. I travelled the globe and worked in a number of different countries, volunteered where I could to really try and build, you know, a strong working knowledge of primates, not only within zoos, but also spending time in countries overseas. So, you know, traveling to Madagascar, traveling to Africa, and traveling to Asia, where I guess, you know, that country continues to draw me back there every year. I wrote two books during that time with David Blissett, which was an absolute blessing. I was privileged to see orangutans return to the wild, you know, spend a few weeks travelling with Jane Goodall. So, yeah, I certainly during that time achieved a great lot, you know, some incredible opportunities. And I think it comes about during the fact that I worked really hard and I was dedicated and I made a lot of personal sacrifices to achieve those strong career goals that I had. I left Taronga, I think, when I was about 45, and I headed down to the south coast to Mogo Zoo, which is a privately owned zoo. So I think initially it was a little bit of a change for me, going from a very large government organisation to a small private zoo run by a lady called Sally Patey. But I absolute adoration and respect for the work that she had done in that space. And Mogo continues to be a shining light for me in my career. I worked with an incredible, dedicated, passionate and downright funny bunch of people at Mogo. That certainly made my 3 years an absolute pleasure. And who doesn't like the South Coast? Literally 5 minutes from the beach. And so I could get up every morning, walk out to the beach, spend time with my dogs, come home. I still make jokes with some of the keepers that I worked with there. Even now, we often talk about at the end of the day, we'd say we're turning left or right today. If we turned left, we're all heading to the local gym. If we turn right, we're heading to the local pub. So it's something we still joke about. So, but in particular, I think what I'm really lucky about is that this part of my career at Sydney Zoo, and I've been a part of Sydney Zoo now for 6 years, I'm going to say it's been my favourite. So being part of, I guess, you know, a new organisation, seeing the challenges, the hard work and the strategies that they've went through to build the zoo that exist there today, and I've just celebrated 5 years, I think. So it's a great balance of both, you know, private and public facilities, and it's certainly been an incredible journey. And I feel grateful to be able to work alongside a very talented bunch of people. So that's like a zoo life for me.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and you know, and I guess it's that connection and that ability to work in these amazing facilities that continues to inspire me to go out and try and share that and do something for their wild counterparts. So I do spend a lot of time in Indonesia with a very close friend, Flo Butcher from Melbourne Zoo, where we work closely together on enrichment and welfare programs, particularly for Boss Foundation through Boss Australia, which you know, the Boss Foundation team are the largest rescue, rehab and release organisation for Bornean orangutans in the world. So we literally have just come back a couple of weeks ago, and Flo just landed back a few days ago. She stayed a little bit longer. But, yeah, it's always, you know, making that connection, working alongside the local technicians and the people that work there is such an incredible joy.
It is, yeah, it's literally fascinating listening to your story, and you have accomplished so much within the time that you've worked in the industry. And like you said, you've clearly worked so incredibly hard to be able to achieve what you have achieved. One thing I was going to ask you is I generally, I guess if I'm totally honest, have always thought about working with primates is slightly intimidating in a species that has not always been something that's kind of drawn straight away to me, just based on, I guess, how similar they are to us and their social structures. But you've obviously said that that's something that drew you to working with them.
Yeah.
Have you ever felt intimidated by their capabilities, like whilst working with them, or has that always been something that you've just kind of seen as a positive?
That's a great question. It's interesting because I think I've always felt a connection to them. So it's never for me been based on fear or those sorts of feelings. I've always been, I don't know, very aware of the capacity and the capabilities and the intelligence and integrity of our great apes in particular, and just generally the social complexities across primates. However, you get me to stand next to, say, I don't know, like a big cat or a really large horse now, and I immediately feel intimidated. So it's interesting when, you know, I've said this, it's very ironic, you know, you're working alongside, say, a large group of chimpanzees where an adult male has an estimated strength of 5 human men, compounded with an intelligence like us. And you know, mm-hmm. these animals are very strategic and, you know, they're very calculating, but they also show that very soft, I think, loving side that we also see in us. So I think that's why it's never about intimidation for me. It's about an absolute adoration, respect, and I'm simply in awe of them.
Yeah, I think I'm a bit the same as Stacey. I've always had that kind of, whoa, like, that's there are species that, you know, you're definitely smarter than me. You're just watching them for a short period of time. Yeah, you can see their capabilities. So it's interesting what species we're drawn to. And yeah, that makes us.
Well, I am going to say that, believe it or not, besides primates, my other favorite animals are dogs.
Yeah.
Oh, same.
I mean, yeah.
Who doesn't love dogs?
I also like cats, but we won't go there. Now, obviously, you've worked with primates for such a long time and you have so much experience with them, and your passion for them is just incredible. And we love to hear that, and we can't wait to delve a little bit more into that. Now, we said that they're such a complex species and they're just so intelligent. With your experience, how have you found it's best to provide the highest welfare and stimulation for them with that in mind?
I think, you know, certainly if I look back over my 30-year career, and this is just very ironic because I also spend time teaching Certificate 3 in Wildlife and Animal Management for TAFE out at Richmond. And so I'm you know, I'm trying to educate the next generation of zookeepers. And I was actually chatting to them sort of last week about the fact that the concept of animal welfare really has evolved in the last 30 years. In my time, about, you know, if we look back at, you know, we talk about something like the 5 freedoms, which is what we talked about with animal welfare through the animal platform, is that, you know, freedom from injury, freedom from disease. And then we've gone on to this, you know, higher level concept of 5 domains, where we actually want animals in our care to participate in the choices that they can make and have some sort of control or agency over their lives. And I think when you're talking about welfare around great apes, I think we know that, you know, for us as highly intelligent sentient animals, we know that, you know, orangutans, chimpanzees, great apes, you know, gorillas share that sort of level of complexity and intelligence. How do we provide them with that same opportunity for making choice? And it's a tough question, and I think we're still on that journey, and I think we're still learning to provide strong animal welfare opportunities for them. But certainly for me, I'm going to say that I'm very proud of the organisations that I work in, because having spent time travelling and seeing what the wild situation is like, it's hard. The wild is confronting. The wild isn't that glamorous picture you see on the TV sometimes. It's a tough gig. And where possible, I think we need to continue in trying to understand the behavioural complexity of the animals that we look after in our wildlife organisations. If we are going to be those true conservationists for the future. And I feel like the wildlife parks and zoos and organisations in Australia do it very well. So, and it's been open to that ongoing learning. So I guess in summary, I try to understand what the animals want, try to provide them with opportunities to do what they want to do, and yeah, make life as happy as I can for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you said, you know, when you're comparing their wild counterparts, often it's always like the grass is greener, like imagine, you know, them thriving in the wild. Like you said, some of these species, yeah, particularly like an orangutan with its habitat being destroyed in front of your eyes. Yeah. Like I personally was going down a river in Borneo and we just seen some orangs, and then down the river you just see them being felled, and it's like, this is tough gig. So for you to say that it's hard in the wild, hard. It is, yeah.
And I think if we look back, you know, we know that obviously in the right thing is for animals to be in the wild, but we know that's just not a reality anymore, that for many species today that are facing an unsafe future, extinction for some of the species we see today is very real, and it's going to be wildlife parks, zoos and organisations like ours that are going to make a difference and maybe the only place we actually see these animals. And, you know, besides facing the natural challenges or traditional challenges of competing for food and looking for mates, we're now looking at the realities and the impact of an ever-increasing human population and an ever-increasing deforestation, global challenges with mining, palm oil. It's just, you can go across the globe and see all of those things, and we realise that the wild just ain't that pretty anymore.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think following on a little bit from your point there as well, you know, conservation has changed over the years, and I think with so many species at threat and so many breeding programs being the backup populations for a lot of wild species, maybe some of our time spent for conservation is now spent on how can we better the life and the welfare of the animals in our care, and how can we imitate those natural behaviors, and how can we understand that animal more so they can showcase those natural behaviors more within human care, allowing us to be able to provide them a better quality of life, because they are the species for the future in our care. Because, you know, being realistic, like you guys all said, unfortunately, extinction isn't a rare thing anymore, and it's a higher reality.
I think you've summarised it really well. I look back and think about the number of species that I saw in those traditional zoos many years ago, and I think what we do now is we do less, but we do them better. And I think the reality of not being able to potentially save everything is what we, I guess it's what we have to face, but making sure that, you know, we do provide the best care we can with the resources that we have and in the organisations that we, you know, we have those animals being held in. So, and it's really encouraging to see, you know, zoos being able to contribute to conservation through reintroduction programs, golden-lined tamarin, Kozlowski horse, you know, regent honeyeater, orange-bellied parrots. The species list is endless, and actually you see these populations surviving and thriving, I think, is a credit to where the zoo industry is is evolving, but it's not there yet. It's still got more work to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Always growth, for sure. Like we mentioned a little bit before we started recording, that we are obviously quite good friends with Dean, and he spoke recently, one of your colleagues, about some of the incredible station training and behavioural management work that you have been doing with the chimps at Sydney Zoo. I was wondering if you could maybe touch on, though, what sort of your training sessions prioritise, if you're looking at other behaviours, or what sort of goals you're looking at achieving with your chimps.
So originally when Dean and I chatted about setting up a chimp training program with the chimps at Sydney Zoo, both of us have been involved in training chimps in the past, and it was great that we could find some common ground on the fact that what we wanted to do, first of all, is to make sure that we provided a motivating opportunity for the animals to want to participate in a training program that they were eager to participate in. So we wanted to make it interesting. We wanted to also support and accept social fluctuations that exist within chimpanzee hierarchy. So we know that chimps have an alpha male, and, you know, it's a multi-male, multi-female group. and that always social interactions will take priority over what else is happening. And I often like to refer to myself, and I guess keepers generally, is we should really be resource providers. So not necessarily, you know, daily routines should really evolve around what the animals want. So that was where we started. We had lots of discussions about how we were going to support the chimp training program. And then it came down to some implementing some very solid husbandry and sort of veterinary training behaviours. It's important, obviously, when you're managing animals like chimps that we do need to undertake regular health checks. We see animals, whether or not they hurt themselves or, you know, animals as they get a little bit older, we want to be able to make that process nice and simple and smooth for them. So things like training hand injection, you know, body part presentation, and also getting them to sit there calmly and quietly and participating in an active training session. So, and it also includes being able to shift animals in and out and throughout the building and the facility, because you do want to make that process something that they're very eager to participate in, and that we make it of high value so that it's a tool that they see as something positive to their day. So it's been great working with Dean in that space. So I feel like we've sort of combined our skill sets really well. So my knowledge and experience with primates and great apes and his training experience.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I really love how you started that whole answer by talking about your motivators and like to ensure that the animals are motivated for the training sessions. Like, I think that's such a great mindset to go into a training program with any animal, is like, how are we going to ensure that these animals are motivated to participate in what we want to achieve? It's so like, that's such a great thought that I've never really, you know, thought about actually.
Well, no, it's often you think about when you're training your dogs or your pets at home, and you know that, you know, you can, because they're a domestic species, it's a little bit easier. But when you're dealing with something as socially complex and intelligent as a chimp or an orangutan, that, you know, you want to be able to communicate clearly. You want to be able to provide and motivate for animals to take control and have choice and agency over their lives. So while realizing the realities of having to manage them in a human care environment, so you do need to be able to access different parts of the facility to maintain that for husbandry reasons, or, you know, for implementing enrichment. And it's about making that life a joy. You know, it's about making giving them a happy life, and having a really solid training program, I think, is a part of that whole process. It's a husbandry tool that we need to implement.
Currently, I guess you're working with a group of chimps and orangutans at Sydney Zoo. When it comes down to sort of your training with both different species, like, what do they have different sort of preferences with reinforcement? Do they have different thresholds for training, different preferences with what they're learning? Can you kind of give us a bit of an overview between the two?
Sure. I think, you know, first of all, understanding the differences in behaviour between the species. You know, chimps are a social species, multi-male, multi-female, and there's always something hectic going on. So you can just imagine, I just compare it to, you know, a pack of high school children where, you know, everyone's always trying to go out with a really hot boy, or, you know, someone doesn't like someone else. So there's always something going on. They're just a hectic species. And so they're always doing something. If you look at orangutan, that's traditionally it's really interesting, because I was having this conversation today with someone, that orangutans are often perceived as being a solitary species, and it's interesting to know that they're actually not. That they're a very layered species, so they do have social interactions with different conspecifics in the wild at different age levels, and they do encounter other animals. However, I think the difference essentially is that chimps are pretty good at telling you what they're thinking, whereas orangs will make you work for it a little more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're very quiet, I guess, I don't know, not an introvert, but very subtle. So you really need to work hard to gain the trust and respect of an orangutan, I believe. And you really need to look at the motivation. So they are really going to make you work hard. But equally, I think chimps probably add a, you know, another layer of complexity because you're managing the social issues that are going on in that group and trying to make sure that you respect that. And that's something that I really try to encourage people that I'm working with, is that we must always respect the social interactions. So each of them are just complex, but from a different perspective.
I love those descriptions. You couldn't have worded that better, you know, teenagers. And then
I know,
the,
it's true.
The subtlety of orang.
I wish I could click you this short video that someone sent me the other day. It was an orangutan sitting there in a really big, in a zoo somewhere, in a really big, flat, I don't know, like a big plastic bowl or something. It was huge anyway, and there was some, you know, materials around, and this orangutan was just opening a, it was a female opening and closing a magazine, and she was just looking at it, and someone, whoever was filming the video, obviously caught her eye, and she just turned around and gave them stink eye and then went back to flipping her magazine. And it was just, to me, truly representative of just the, I don't know, the indifference that the orangutan would be. They're both fantastic to work with and have challenges, but just different.
She could have been sitting in a nail salon, just like, oh, hello. Like,
totally. I was thinking someone that was drinking a glass of champagne somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, you know, some famous person that was like, are you watching me? And yeah.
Oh, I love it. Now, as well as your career as a zookeeper, you've taken your passion all around the world, overseeing enrichment and welfare programs, which you mentioned in Borneo. We'd love to hear a little bit more about this, how it came about, and a little bit more about what it entails.
Sure. So started, I think, God, just over 20 years ago, I came across there was Willie Smith, who started a project in Borneo called the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation in, I think it was East Kalimantan at the time, and he was out giving a chat here in Sydney, and I just went up and chatted to him, and I was really interested in the work that he was doing. I then, Voss Australia, which is a partner organisation, was developed in Australia, and basically we decided to fundraise and generate resources for the work that Voss Foundation does. So I then travelled across to East Kalimantan to a place called Semboja Lestari. And what can I say, 20 years on, I've gone 2-3 times a year. I work alongside a lady called Fleur Butcher from Melbourne Zoo. Both of us have welfare qualifications, but we also try and work alongside and collaborate with the staff at Voss. So we talk about managing and providing good welfare for orangutans in our wildlife organisations, but we're talking about very small numbers. These facilities, particularly in central Kalimantan, at one point in time had 600 orphaned animals. And that just gives you a bit of a snapshot of just, I guess, the global scale of the issue. And we're only talking about orangs here. So Fleur and I worked very hard to try and develop an enrichment program where we could get volunteers to come in. And if you do jump onto the Voss Australia website, we actually run volunteer trips from October to March where you come across for a two-week period and you get to work alongside a Voss Australia representative. So Amber Castle is our volunteer coordinator. I normally take one trip a year for that particular situation, but we teach people about some of the local issues. You get to work and collaborate with the local technicians. You get to build enrichment for the orangutans, for the sun bears, and you get to participate in that program and see what enrichment does to help build a better life for animals in human care. So that's sort of what really motivated Fleur and I to want to try and help when we realised that the animals in our care had resources. These guys over there are fighting and doing an incredible job with so little. So we felt like we needed to help, and so we try where possible to raise money and to raise resources and take it with us. And just, yeah, give the incredible, talented technicians of Boss Foundation some help where we can.
All of what you just said, Lou, is absolutely fascinating to hear. And it is really nice to hear that there are some incredible programs like that happening for species out in the wild. And we're not just relying on those programs within human care as well. And it's probably quite humbling to realize, you know, how much we sort of ask for a lot within zoos and aquariums in Australia, and realize that you can still achieve the same goals with such minimal items in countries where animals like that are found. What's sort of been your biggest challenge with setting up those sort of enrichment programs?
Great question. I think the reality is that so many of the animals that we have in our zoos in Australia do have a really high standard of welfare. So, and the challenge in some of the sanctuaries, and we hear the word sanctuary and we immediately think that it's a wonderful, wonderful life. It's just trying to, I guess, meet the needs of all of those animals with the resources that they have, and we know that that's tough. So, you know, we're just dealing with things on a completely different scale. And I guess, you know, for me, I always say, you know, with conservation, you know, think globally but act locally. And I guess, you know, when Fleur and I travel over to Indonesia so often, you know, orangutans are one species across so many that are facing these challenges. But I think it's the reality of knowing that we can't do everything, but we want to try and make a difference to what we can do. And I think for me, overall, the challenge is trying to come to terms with, don't know if we're going to make it. At times you do ask yourself, are we fighting a battle that we're never going to win? But we have to keep trying. And I guess that's the hardest thing, is overcoming that challenge at times when you wonder. And you watch the news and, you know, I look around and think that, you know, we're a country that has so many resources. And to hear that we're still putting koalas on the endangered species list, you know, things like that. I don't know. It's that, to me, is the challenge, is trying to remain on that journey.
Yeah, that's such a good point, and actually a really great point about the koalas and reflection of how lucky and how many resources we do have in a country like this compared to countries that you're going over to and working within. And I think it would be great actually to pop that website that you mentioned about. We'll share that on our socials so that people can see that there is those opportunities to go out and just help if they feel like they want to contribute something. Like, you know, that's such a fantastic way of doing things like that.
And you get to see, and that's what I love so much about the Boss Australia Enrichment Program, because we're an NGO. The money that we get from this program directly goes back to support the conservation, you know, in Borneo. I'm very well supported by the organisation, by Sydney Zoo that I work for. They give me the time to go and do those great things. People come over and connect with the locals. They connect with the animals. They get to make enrichment that actually the animals get to use. So they see that happening, and they see the real impact on what they're doing. And part of their money goes to providing the resources for those animals in human care, with the potential for some of them to go back to the wild.
I think just really quick. I was just going to say, just what you said, Lou, about being able to see it in person. I remember when Tess and I actually interviewed a girl, Sophie, about, she does a lot of sort of work with the poaching teams out and with rhinos in Africa. And she said, you know, you hear all about it. We talk all about it in our presentations, in our shows, and in every single day life as a zoo. But when you're in front of what the actual reality is, like, that's, you're never going to be able to comprehend that until you're there. And, you know, like, I've never experienced that. And it's something that would be horrendous to see, but also so eye-opening and such a reality check for what is happening around the world and how devastating it can be.
Yeah, it can be. There are tough days when you realise what's happening and you realise the challenges that you face. But, you know, you surround yourself by like-minded people. And I say that Fleur and I do very well in helping each other through the journey. And then you spend time with the the Boss Foundation team, and I'm so inspired by their passion and their determination to make a difference. It's contagious. So they continue to be the inspiration.
And just going back on the enrichment that you provide for those animals, can you give us a bit of an insight as to what that might be? Like, what would you be providing for those orangutans as an example?
Sure. There's a long approval list that's overseen by the internal enrichment technicians at both of those sanctuaries. But it'll be things that we can use within the environment. So we'll often say, for example, harvest large amounts of bamboo, and we'll make I guess like a vegetable puree of some sort that we insert into chunks of bamboo. We'll freeze that, and then the animals have to try and extract that. So we try to create activities that require them to use tools, because they are tool using animals, and also items that continue to provide cognitive challenge. So we're always working on that. Fleur and I also do work around the welfare code that the Boss Foundation has, so making sure that we provide an equal standard of care. So and that's what the volunteers will get to see.
Yeah, that would be so rewarding to have those volunteers, you know, see that. But also, if there are opportunities for those animals to be released back out into the wild, that they've kept up that skill set, in care as well.
That's the primary goal, is to try and maintain, you know, a cognitive challenge and stimulation where animals remain motivated. But not everyone makes it back. Unfortunately, some animals can't, whether or not that's through physical disability or just resilience. They're just not able to come out the other side of the reason why they ended up in a human care situation in the first place. But the team give it the best shot they can.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the best you can do. I would love to finish off chatting to you a little bit about your books, because you have mentioned briefly that you have written two different books. Yep. That have been highly regarded by some pretty well-known people. Do you want to maybe touch on sort of what brought you to that and wanting to write those books that you've done?
Well, look, I wish I could take the glory for it, but David Blissett, actually, who I've written both books with, he approached me many years ago for the first book, which is Our Primate Family. And I think I had met David very briefly at Taronga. He was doing some work there, and he was writing articles and stuff. And he saw me on, I think at the time I was on a 60 Minutes program. The 60 Minutes team had travelled. I travelled with them for 2 weeks over into Indonesia, and they looked at, it was called our orphans, orangutan orphans. And basically the guys travelled with me to see just the level of work that goes into releasing orangutans back into the wild. So it was an incredible experience. I was in a helicopter with Alison Langdon, and then we're ending up in the thick jungles of Borneo, and I'm fairly certain I had to borrow a towel off her at some point. But he saw that video, he saw that snippet, that 60 minute video. And the thing I learned about the 60 Minutes team was that, have you guys ever watched it? And you see at the end of each program or end of each topic, there's a tick, tick, tick moment.
Mm-hmm.
So when you watch 60 Minutes, see if you notice that. And I didn't realise, but Alison said to me, oh, every time they do a story, they're not sure how they'll end the program, like who will get the tick, tick, tick moment. Anyway, it was coming towards the end, and I ended up with the tick, tick, tick moment, because in typical Lou fashion, I burst into tears on national television talking about the passion and the hard work and the joy and the connection I feel going to Indonesia and working with the Boss Foundation team. So that inspired him to reach out and ask me if I would write a book. So it was interesting because, funny enough, I was travelling back to Indonesia, I think only a few months later, and I was staying there for about 3 months. And so it really gave me the opportunity to write my story. So yeah, and that's how the first one came about. So I guess it was significant animals that I'd worked with in my zoo career, and the connections I had made, which had motivated me to go out into the jungle to try and help.
We'll have to add the link to that episode of 60 Minutes as well, just so we can watch that as well.
All I'm going to say is look at the front. Alison did my hair. It looks fantastic, but you catch a glimpse of the back and she didn't do that. So it looks like I haven't cut my hair for a week.
You're in the middle of the jungle. It's fine.
I know. I was so surprised that she had a hair dry with her. So that was that one. And then David and I have continued to remain very good friends. And we keep talking about writing a third book, but this one will be about dogs. the second book, A Manx Stories, what we wanted to do was to, I guess, go out and reach the people that had really made a difference but hadn't reached global notoriety. So they weren't internationally recognised like the Jane Goodalls or the David Attenborough, you know, all these famous people. And there's so many people that I have had the privilege of encountering across my career. A lady called Jacqueline Sunderland Groves, who was the first person, I think, to photograph the Cross River Gorilla. And she did that work in Nigeria and Cameroon. And I'd gotten to know Jackie through my work in Boss. Anton, he was one of the key contributors to the discovery of the Tapanuli orangutan. And I sat in a cafe in Vietnam with him and Dr. Colin Groves, the leading taxonomist, when they had the initial conversation about studying skulls and looking at whether or not there was another species of orangutan. Thilo Nadler, who is an incredible man that started Phuc Phong National Park in Hanoi, a guy that's from Germany, used to work at the zoo in Frankfurt, he's done that whole rescue centre. So many species of langurs and gibbons that wouldn't exist today if it wasn't due to the work that Thilo had done. They're three significant people across so many, and that's what A Manx Stories does, is to share the stories and the hard work of so many people that we don't hear about. But what we wanted to highlight was that everyone has a role to play. Everyone. I think of conservation as a puzzle, and we all have a piece. So it was really a privilege to reach out to all those people to hear their stories. And to me, it's my favorite book.
It's it's such an amazing idea to be able to give people a platform to just highlight and shine on some of the amazing things people are doing around the world that, like, you just don't know about. And if you're not particularly into that species, or it's not, you know, your sort of topic, you miss out on those things. But like, even you telling me those few things just then, it's fascinating, and it's so reassuring that there is so much good being done for animals around the planet.
And I have to, like, I'd had this idea. I didn't know what to do for the second book, and David came up with this, because I said, there's so many people I want to connect with. And it was just, I'm so incredibly proud of that one, just because I get to highlight the so many incredible people I've met throughout my lifetime.
Yeah, your career is amazing, and I love the amount of people that have influenced you, but also that you're able to basically share their experiences through these books as well. So
yeah.
I'll add it to my book list.
So the first book's got a chimp on the front, and the second book's got an orangutan on the front.
Okay, love that. Easy. Now, we do love to end our episodes with our listener questions, and we did have one sent through that we would love to ask. It was, what behaviours have been the most challenging to train for any primate species?
Wow, where do I go with that? I'm just trying to actually...
It's a loaded question. It's a big one.
I think just participation, you know, motivation. I don't know. It's like if I had to say, I don't know, because primates always present you with a challenge.
Mm.
So, and what have I really liked, what I've really enjoyed about chatting with Dean is when he explains the challenges around communication. So if I want to ask you to do something, we can have a conversation because we're sharing the same language. I think the most challenging thing is the realization that we don't speak the same language. So how can we make sure that we're communicating effectively with the animals in our care? Mm-hmm. Unless you want a specific behavior, I think for me it's just been about understanding and gaining common ground and realizing that, you know, your animals don't automatically understand what you're saying. So we as trainers need to be better communicators.
That's such a good answer. I love that. Like there's,
right.
You know, that's some people, I wasn't sure if you were going to go down the like hand target or yeah, like blood draw, no, but hey, let's just dive deeper into that. That's so good.
Yeah, it's like to me, all of those things you would know yourself that they're going to be different for different species. But at the end of the day, I think it's the hardest thing is our communication skills in that training platform. It's without a doubt the hardest thing.
Yeah, 100%. Leo, I honestly swear to you when I say this, I do not say this often, but this might be possibly one of my favorite conversations that we've ever had on the podcast. You have really changed my mindset around primates, and you know, even just going back to the first few sentences that you said about, you know, why the species stood out for you, and it's really fascinating, and it's totally changed my eyes around working with an animal that you do, and the experience that you've had is phenomenal. The teachings, the learnings that you're passing on to people every single day, they are incredibly lucky to learn from you. And I really hope, I know people are going to get not just a lot out of this episode from working within zoos and with primates, but also the aspect of the conservation element, the side of, you know, hey, there is all these things that we can do out in the field as well. So as much as we would love to talk to you all night, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I cannot thank you enough for, you know, spending your evening with us and sharing your whole career. It's fascinating.
I've loved it. It's been great. And, you know, please come back in, come to Sydney Zoo. I'd love to have a coffee with you guys and introduce you to some pretty amazing.
Sounds good. We'll hold you to it.
Yeah.
Ladies, thank you so much, Luke.
To me as well. Thank you. Good evening.
Well, Daisy, that was a great chat. I think that she really explained the differences between orangutans and chimpanzees really well. And it is really interesting when you think about their social structure, the complexities, and there's a lot involved and some things that I hadn't even thought of. So I can see why you love that chat too. It was really good.
Yeah, so good. I think it's definitely going to be one that a lot of people take a lot away from. And I feel like Lou is someone that I would love to sit down and just have coffee with and just chat, because I feel like she'd have so many stories to tell and so much amazing experience. So yeah, we really hope, guys, that you get a lot out of this episode and enjoy it. But that is us wrapping up for another week. We can't wait to be back in your ears next week.
See you next week. Bye.